This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Few things are more symbolic of Islam than head, face, and body veils, right? Well, today we're talking with author Rafia Zakaria, whose most recent book, Veil, questions the meaning of burqas, hijabs, and niqabs, both in Islam and in the West. Indeed, Zakaria writes, one of the most crucial and most ignored truths about the veil is that, independent of context, it does not have much meaning. Rafia Zakaria, welcome to the Reason Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by discussing the role of veiling women in Islam, which, you know, strikes many people in the United States and I think more broadly in the West as a bizarre kind of phenomenon. Those of us who are old enough and Catholic enough to remember women always wearing something on a head covering when they went to Catholic Mass well into the late 60s and even mid 70s, forget about that. But, you know, what is the theological rationale for veiling women in Islam? And then what are some of the social and historical functions that that veiling serves?
Well, one of the key things I think to remember when the topic of the veil comes up as it pertains to Muslims and Islam is that this is a contested issue within Islamic theology. So there isn't consensus on whether veiling is required or not required or obligatory or optional. And beneath this, you know, beneath the idea of the veil and beneath this sort of contestation is that the central idea or the central prescription within Islamic scripture is towards modesty. And so it's an interpretation of how you see modesty. There are instances, you know, traditions from the Prophet Muhammad that essentially say that, you know, women should cover their hair and they should cover their arms and have long garments. But the interpretation, again, the larger kernel is modesty. The other important thing I think to remember is that the prescription to modesty is not only for women, it is also for men, in that men are also not supposed to dress in a way that's flashy, that attracts attention to their bodies or to what they're wearing in terms of gold or silks or precious metals, are not prescribed or not encouraged for men either. Of course, you know, you have, you know, then it's a similar story, I think, in most religions, is that the interpretation of faith has largely been in the hands of men. And so there's an undue attention to the prescription toward modesty for Muslim women and very little attention to the prescription for modesty for men. There's also kind of a, you know, what you see in contemporary terms, a sort of distillation of the idea of modesty, which has arguably very kind of anti-materialist, anti-consumerist kinds of roots. Islam was a very poor religion when it started. Its adherents did not have a lot of resources to this idea that, you know, if you dress modestly, it's okay if you're then driving a Ferrari and living in a palace.
There's a lot of that going around in Catholic, Christian, Protestant circles in the West, right, where you can be a minister and you wear a shabby suit, but you live in a mansion and all that. So maybe that's something that Muslims and Christians can get together on, right? Looking at the hypocrisy of the people who are telling them to live a simple, purpose-driven life. Describe, you know, veil is a phenomenal read, and I highly recommend it to anybody who wants to understand, you know, veiling from a person who has experienced. Can you describe, and the veiling happens when a girl meets puberty, right, typically?
Typically, yes. That is that is when you're supposed to start covering your hair. Of course, sometimes, you know, there's little girls want to wear the veil because they want to look like their moms or their sisters, and so you'll see little girls going around with the headscarf as well. It is supposed, I mean, technically you're only supposed to wear it where there might be men who are not related to you. So women who wail must wail in front of anybody who is not their brother, their maternal uncle, their father, their son. So other than those,
their husband. So there's a theological explanation for it. Is it also, or is it made explicit, or is it implicit that, you know, that female hair, you know, and this is not just in Islam, there are parts of Judaism that kind of talk this way as well, but that, you know, female hair is an incitement to sexual aggression or sexual appetites, you know, that the arms, that, I mean, is this pretty transparently an attempt to control female sexuality?
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, this stems within the Quran. There is no explicit, direction of what the clothing should look like, or that hair, you know, is somehow part of this kind of unfettered female sexuality. But, the traditions and interpretations that make up the corpus of the Islamic understanding of the veil were, you know, more often than not derived by Muslim male scholars who wrote on and on since, you know, the 7th century. And so you have kind of a development, definitely a development of the idea that these parts of a woman's body, are not to be seen, and the hair is included among them. And it's an interesting idea because. And this is why, you know, I wanted the book to focus so centrally on the veil as it exists today, and the veil as it exists in sort of in a kind of a catalytic reaction with the context in which it is found, is because for instance in Pakistan, in a good part of the 20th century, the emphasis really was not on covering your hair. It was always on covering your chest. And so we always wore, a big scarf that we wrapped around, you know, the top half of our body over your tunic or your shirt, and didn't really cover your hair. There is, of course, then, and to the extent that within urban Pakistan, urban Karachi, where I grew up, and I grew up in a fairly conservative family, but the emphasis again was just wearing that, not uncovering your hair. And to the extent that at the time, you know, there were women who would go around specifically covering their hair, and that was seen as a very political kind of move, which sort of reflected kind of a burgeoning Islamist movement within Pakistan.
Can you describe your experience with veiling briefly? Because we're going to get to kind of what does veiling mean in Islam or in countries like Pakistan, and then what it means in the United States or in Western Europe. One of the things that's great about the book is that it takes, you know, it's exactly the same thing. It's the same object, and it takes on radically different meanings. And one of the things that's fascinating about your book is that the experience of the woman in the veil or behind the burqa or under the burqa is often left out of any analysis whatsoever. So describe your experience with veiling a bit.
Well, the book begins with this observation, from contemporary Pakistan, which is, I was in a waiting room in Karachi in a hospital, and I had to spend a lot of time there. My mother was in the ICU, and there isn't any kind of legally enforced gender segregation in Pakistan. So this was a room that's kind of a public space, but that, there are men and women in it, kind of forced there by their circumstances. I was fully covered. My head was covered, but not with a formal headscarf. It's just like a loose scarf, and that is kind of the traditional Pakistani outfit, a shalwar kameez. And it was difficult to kind of spend a lot of time there with a lot of men. And of course, there are men who come from all different kinds of backgrounds. So Pakistan is a rural urban country. In this case, there were these attendants, male attendants of someone who was a kind of village elder who was also in the ICU. And so they were in there, and obviously they were not used to having women around, especially women whose faces weren't covered. The book began then because there was another woman there who was fully veiled, wearing like a garment that came up all the way to her feet. And I remember her just, she would pace up and down the room. She would loudly have snacks. She would have loud phone conversations. I mean, she was just, free in that space in a way that I didn't feel. And that made me really question what even my own assumptions of the veil and freedom and public space and claiming public space for women was all about. And it made me kind of undertake this investigation into what the veil was and what it is now. So, growing up, like I mentioned, the emphasis was really never on covering your hair. But there were all these other ways, in which public and private space was separated. So, we didn't cover our hair, my mother, myself, my grandmother did. But again, just like loosely, she didn't wear a headscarf. But it was also true that we didn't really have any interaction with men that we didn't know. Now, they might not strictly have been a part, like the uncle, like the definition of related male, but if not, they were just, so maybe my mother would see her sister's husband or someone like that. But it wasn't, it was definitely just family at the most, maybe someone who came to the house to sell something or something like that. It was not that they were out sort of in the public sphere where they would, meet men that they didn't know on a regular basis. It was the same with me. I went to an all-girls school where there were literally no men allowed inside. And so, and that is definitely a very middle-class, upper-middle-class life in Pakistan. And so there is a class dimension to the veil in Pakistan in the sense that the women who are in that class, their class protects them from, in a way, from having to veil, right? Because they don't have to be out in public spaces very often. Or if they are, they're public spaces which largely are controlled environments. For instance, even now in malls in Karachi, on most days, you cannot go, like a group of two or three men who don't have any women with them cannot go in to these malls. You're not going to be admitted.
Why not? Because there's too many women there?
Because Yeah, because there are a lot of women there and they don't want men harassing women because ultimately that's going to reduce the number of women that are going to come out there to shop. So, you know, so it's in their interest to kind of police that to the extent that they can. Now, as Pakistan has, so this is, again, like I said, a class thing. But if you are, I would say, you know, and Pakistani women, this has changed from, you know, when I was growing up, where two things have happened. One, in the large urban centers, there are a huge number of women who are now part of the workforce in a way that they weren't in the, even the early 90s, mid-90s, late 90s. And the other thing is that it's a vastly urbanizing country. So it has changed from, you know, being a 60-40 rural-urban to the opposite, to a 60-40 urban-rural. And so you have huge numbers of women who are coming in from the rural areas, you know, who are also then participating in the workforce. So with that many women in the public spaces, and this has kind of intensified both the battle over public space in Pakistan, and it has also created kind of a veil revolution of sorts, where women now know that they have to be in these public spaces. So you got to get to work, you either drive a car or you have to take public transportation, or, you know, you have Kareem, which is kind of Pakistan's version of Uber. You have to take a ride and go in there. So what are you going to do to protect yourself in a country where, first of all, men are not really used to having women around in public spaces, where there's a huge number of men from rural areas who are really not used to it. And finally, that doesn't really have, you know, a lot of legal protections of what could be done, you know, if something does go wrong. So within all of those, for all of those reasons, the veil has sort of become weaponized in a way where, you know, if you, because, you know, anytime women come out into the workforce is the same in the West, you know, there's like a moral gray area because there is this impression that they have to push through against, that they're somehow morally lax or questionable because they're out there in these public spaces. So what the veil does is that it kind of, first of all, it's literally, as I saw in that hospital environment, it's like a physical protection. Like it's one more layer that separates you from, you know, the grit and grime of, and the gaze and the touch and the groping. So it's that. It's a moral kind of protection as well, because, you know, traditionally the veil is associated with being very pious and devout. And so you can kind of signal with that that, you know, you're not there to flirt, or you're not there. I mean, you're there for to get your stuff done, you know, and so that it's a very sort of crucial kind of moral signaling
and
within
that
environment.
You also in the book at one point you note in that there have been some studies done that when people are listening, say in court cases, and you talk about certain, I mean, interesting cases in the West where women are asked to remove their face veils in order to testify, or, you know, et cetera. But that actually that it turns out that when people, and I guess especially men, are listening to women who are veiled or scarved or whatever, that when they're scarved, they actually pay more attention to the substance of what the woman is saying. So in a way, and I want to get to the intersection of veiling and kind of Western feminism, you know, that the veil actually foregrounds the substance of a woman in a way of what she's saying or what she's thinking. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, the studies that I talk about definitely found that, which is, you know, counterintuitive, as you said, because, you know, the usual argument is that without you know, without seeing your face, I can't pay attention to what you're saying and really get your facial expressions are necessary for me to sort of make a judgment. And that might be true in terms of judgment, but it's not necessarily true in terms of substance because, you know, I mean, you could, I think the idea is that when you can't see someone's face, your attention is distilled to what they're actually saying, and you tend to pay more attention. So yes, that's absolutely correct. It hasn't prevented, you know, particularly Western governments that are banning full face veils. It hasn't prevented them from doing so, nor has it prevented them from, you know, banning them within the courtroom context.
But, you were veiled, right? Or you veiled yourself during a marriage? Is that correct?
Yes, but that was.
Only- oh, I was going to say, like, how did you feel? I mean, because you know, on the one hand. Again, you know, in the West especially, we look upon the veil as this, you know, and I mean, you talk about this at length. It's simultaneously the veil is a sign of the worst form of patriarchy that we in the enlightened West have left behind. And, you know, some of us will even say, oh, well, it was never as bad in the West as it is elsewhere in the world. But then it's also simultaneous. It's this ability to obscure who's really behind that. And it becomes a kind of way that Islamic women or Muslim women can become terrorists. We don't know who they are. But, you know, it has all of these mixed meanings. But then, you know, when you were veiled, did you feel freer or did you feel is it much more ambivalent than that? Because in one way, you're in a religion that really circumscribes what women are allowed to do. But then it also, as you were talking about, it gives, you know, that woman in the waiting room, like she had the ability to kind of just do her shit, right?
Basically. And I mean, I have to correct you. I mean, I was only veiled for that one ceremony. And then I did wear a headscarf for a time during my teens, but it was only a headscarf. It was never a full face veil.
And so, you describe, by the way, for the listeners before they read the book, and I think it's an inducement to you, describe a couple of stories that are straight out of these were comedies. I'm thinking of things like The Troubles with Angels and Where Angels Go, Trouble Follows. But inevitably, you describe a couple of scenes that could have been set in a Catholic girls' school in the 60s or an all-girls school where you lead a bunch of girls like in unauthorized outings where boys are coming by and you guys are, you know, wearing your headscarves, et cetera. And it's, I mean, for me, one of the things that your book really did, which I think is extremely helpful in a contemporary climate, is, you know, is that like I could recognize a lot of the experiences either that I had or, you know, the America that I grew up in what you were talking about. And it familiarizes something that seems so foreign and so threatening and so off-putting. But I apologize for interrupting you while making a pitch for people to buy your book. But
yes, please buy my book, you know. Please do buy my book. I mean, you know, I think the way to think about it is that, you know, people use whatever they have. And Muslim women at this point are, you know, I mean, the veil is one among a variety of kind of tools available to them. And it's impossible. I mean, there are different aspects of the veil that are important to different people. You know, within the West, for instance, I think it's absolutely impossible to dislocate the veil from its political meaning. You know, so you have Muslim populations that feel, particularly in Western Europe, places like France, where they feel that they've suffered disenfranchisement and they're kind of culturally invisible in that their identity isn't really culturally acknowledged as French, right? And so, you know, and then obviously also spatially kind of invisible because of where they're located, you know, in these kind of ghettoized suburbs. And so And then you have a government that is sort of legislating what people can wear in the public sphere. And the two of those things come together where the veil then becomes a very political symbol of rebellion against the French state and against the French system. Now that is, you know, I mean, you wouldn't get the same meaning from it, obviously, in a place like Pakistan, where, you know, you could wear a headscarf and you're blending in. It leads to kind of interesting questions, both for feminists and for theologians, because then from a theological perspective, if you are wearing a headscarf to attract attention in a way, or a full face veil to yourself, then is that still a modest act, you know, or is that still part of a prescription to modesty? And then, you know, feminists, of course, face a huge dilemma because, you know, on one hand, they want to argue for the freedom to do anything. On the other hand, how much choice is going to be something that you're going to support? So if I support a woman wearing a full face veil, do I then also support that aspect of the Taliban's
politics? Yeah, well, how do you answer that? Because, you know, that's one of the questions. And I think when I say feminists in the West or Western feminists, I don't even mean, simply women. But I know a lot of, mostly everybody I know believes in, obviously in an inequality between the sexes, or we might say now among the sexes. And are women choosing to veil themselves? How do you answer that from a feminist perspective? If you want to grant, as much autonomy and freedom to individual women to do whatever they want, but then is that an acceptable choice? How do you walk that line and kind of look at all the ins and outs?
Well, first of all, the one thing I am sure about is that there should not be any government, whether it's the Iranians and the Saudis forcing
right, or the Canadian, or the Canadian government saying
or
you
the
can't.
Canadians, yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Or the French or the Canadian who say you can't. So I think that as a feminist, that is like the first order.
And I want to point out, while you wouldn't call yourself a libertarian, as a libertarian, also true that this should not be a matter of the state. It should be something different. But so that's the first step. We're not talking about state intervention here.
Yes. Beyond that, I think that the questions are a little easier. I mean, I don't think that girls, they can experiment with the veil like I did. I was not yet 18. But I think that the choices have to be interpreted from within the context. So, and that requires, frustratingly for some, a more case-by-case analysis. And, you cannot say that no girl XYZ should be allowed to wear a veil, because there are girls who come from families where really there is no pressure in either direction. And that's why I say that, I would even go so far to say is that the veil right now in the world that we're living today, really, I'm not sure that, I think theology is probably the lowest order of reasoning for wearing the veil. I think that there are a lot of other political issues that have completely overshadowed kind of whatever kind of theological or spiritual meaning there was behind it, simply because it's a symbol that has, taken on such inordinate power in relation to kind of its physical reality that the context and the politics of where they are and what they want to signal is so crucial. I mean, even in the West, I would say, I'll confess, it's very frustrating even to be the subject of that, because I don't wear the veil. And I know that the second I'm speaking in any kind of a public forum, the fact that I don't wear the veil is then, you know, there's like a list of sort of interpretive judgments that happens right away about my politics. Whereas it's the same thing, is that if I did wear the veil, then there would be a kind of succession of interpretive judgments. And those are frustrating, right? Because there are people who, and then of course, you know, you have to add to that the fact that brown people, are still exoticized within Western context. So, you know, in some cases, there are people who would add a greater degree of authenticity. They want a Muslim woman in a veil at their event, you know, because that is like the real Muslim woman, while the rest of, and so, you know, there aren't any kind of clean lines in this issue, simply because so many political contexts have recognized its value as a political tool. And often that has to do almost nothing with women. I mean, to be really honest, it has absolutely nothing to do with women or with respecting their autonomy or their desire to control what goes on their body.
It's amazing you can get out of the house in the morning, to be quite honest, with all of that. I mean, you know, and in different ways, we all face that kind of thing, but that seems extremely strong. One of the contexts that you write about in the contemporary West, and you know, let's talk about the United States especially, you write about the veil as security threat. Talk a little bit about that, because I think that's, you know, for a lot of Americans, you know, and it's ridiculous to be, you know, we're almost, the 21st century is practically over as far as I'm concerned, but we're still kind of encountering Islam for the first time. But the veil as security threat, how is that governing so much in an American context?
Well, I mean, you know, let's face it, Islam has become front and center, enemy of the age, enemy of the day in America, where so much of American politics is now pivoted against this very tiny religious minority in the country, and against sort of banning Muslims and registries and all of this, this kind of inordinate, crazy-making fear. And anytime you have that, you have the sort of, appendage that comes with it, is that, okay, well, first it was just the Muslim men that were dangerous, but now, you know, there's the beast has to be fed, you know, and you have to keep feeding it, and so now it's Muslim women as well, particularly veiled Muslim women, and a lot of this of course has been imported from Europe, and the sort of the rhetoric and the sort of imagery used by far right groups in Western Europe, who have very much and it's easy, but it's kind of crazy, because you've got that coming from places like France and the UK, which have over 10% Muslim population. So it's a different dynamic, and a very different kind of demographic of Muslims make up their minorities. Most of them are from areas that they colonized, and so it's migrants from.
Whereas in the United States, you have cities like Dearborn or Hamtramck, Michigan, which are they might be Muslim majority, but they also have more Little League baseball teams than typical city, American cities the same size.
Right. I mean, so you have a demographic that's, you know, largely educated, middle class, and not from any particular country, which actually, you know, within the Muslim community in the U.S., it's always interesting because, you know, there's we don't necessarily all have a lot in common. Because I don't know a lot about Somalia, and Somalis don't necessarily know a lot about South Asia or Pakistan. So, but of course, you know, we're all Muslims, so we're all dangerous and awful and sinister. And that has definitely become a huge symbol where now, anytime that the veil, so it comes like if you've gone from 2001, where people like Carolyn Maloney stood on the floor of the House of Representatives, put on a burqa and talked about how America has to go to war to, you know, save these women who are under the burqa. And then all the way now to 2017, where it's like, okay, everyone under a burqa is a terrorist. Okay, they've got a suicide belt under there. And that is definitely the assumption. And, you know, like I said, neither of those have anything to do with the truth. Because, you know, the U.S. didn't invade Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban. They wanted a presence there, you know, for the war on terror. It didn't have anything to do with the women, but it was a good poster moment. And, you know, and right now, I mean, first of all, I would be hard-pressed to say that there are, maybe what, a few hundred, a thousand total women, and that's being generous, who would wear the full face veil in the U.S., Muslim women. But then, you know, I mean, it goes from there. So you start with that, and then you say, okay, well, no, the headscarf ones are also terrorists. And that has become a huge problem. I mean, there are now, I mean, you saw the incident in Portland. You know, there's lots of other incidents, some of which don't even get reported, where women with headscarves have headscarves pulled. There's other women who accost them in stores and start yelling all these slurs. And that has become a real problem. And it has become to the point that now, I mean, mosques have to have these safety classes for Muslim women who wear the headscarf, because they are now subject to so much negative attention and so much Islamophobia. And that is a true tragedy. I can honestly say even maybe 5 years ago, I would not ever have predicted that would happen.
It is amazing how hair, you know, I use that loosely to also include scarves, but what a powerful signifier throughout history. I mean, when you look at the Cavaliers in the English Civil War, you know, with long flowing locks versus the roundheads with kind of proto-punk haircuts, punk in America. I used to work at a magazine where my editor would dye her hair, and this was back in the 80s when it was kind of cutting edge, but she would dye her hair magenta or bright green, and people would go ape on the street. Like it, you know, when you mess with hair, it really gets under people's skin. It's it is a bizarre and kind of fascinating fact of life, I guess, pretty much everywhere. Can I ask, you know, you also in the book, you've said that Western feminists tend to see Muslim women who are suffering under a kind of more obvious and repressive patriarchy in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan, India, as the lesser sister, in, you know, as their lesser sisters. How does that change? And does it need to change?
Well, yes, it needs to change because, you know, I mean, one of the worst legacies, I would say, of colonialism that we have is this idea that, you know, the white people of the world have been this benevolent force that has gone out and civilized the rest of the world without any kind of idea of, you know, the heritage or the struggles of the people who who lived in those societies, or the idea of, you know, matriarchal societies and emancipation movements that were already in existence long before then. And so, you know, as someone who writes, you're always kind of working up against this wall, because while we're no longer in the colonial era, we are arguably in a neo-colonial or neo-imperialist moment, where a lot of the same sort of rhetoric is regurgitated in, for instance, aid discourse, you know, in the way foreign aid is disbursed, and the way projects for women in other parts of the world are conceptualized. So it's very much understood as this, you know, we are the vanguard of feminism here in the white Western world, and we're going to export that and to these women out there who are imagined as not having political identities, as not having really any sort of complexity within their own politics or their own existence. And so that's where that comes from. And I think that the danger has been, or the obstacle has been, is that in sort of conceptualizing this global sisterhood, there's always been kind of a thread that if I talk about that, if I talk about the fact that I don't agree with you on these things, or that you don't have, or that you're being patronizing or condescending, that the sisterhood will crumble. And that has kind of enforced this silence on, particularly on women in the non-West, in the non-white Western world. And that's, you know, I think it's the basis. It has enfeebled the movement. And I would say that in particular reference to Muslim countries, because it's precisely that attitude, I would say, that has facilitated, I wouldn't say it's, you know, solely responsible or a dominant force, but it has been a force in pushing women towards Islamist discourses, where they feel their identity is more, they have a more greater affinity, or that they're recognized for who they are and what they can contribute, as opposed to sort of these, you know, these women you parade on the stage at your gala or whatever, here's my sister from Afghanistan and so on. Whereas you don't really have any kind of concern or any kind of equal intention in terms of having a conversation.
So this is an old problem, right, too, where when people want, this is a more positive version, or it's an attempt to help. But when you were talking about in France, doing things like banning the burqa or banning headscarves in public spaces, one of the things that happens to that, you know, and we assume that that's done out of, you know, and maybe this is too broad an assumption, but it's done because France wants true equality, you know, coming out of the French Revolution, égalité. But then when you're doing that in such a way, you kind of force people to make a choice. And it's kind of like, if you're talking about me and my culture as a threat, I'm going to give you the most Muslim that you can find, and I'm going to double or triple down on an identity that is, you know, just opposite of yours. And I guess you're kind of suggesting that within feminism, there's something similar at work, where if you're a Muslim woman, but your price of admission into a sisterhood is that you're always the little sister, you at a certain point, you're going to be like, screw that. I'm going to hang out with these people because they get me more than you do.
Right. And there's also not this kind of this imputation of being behind, so that we already had our women's movement, you've not had yours, but there's this assumption that that is the template that is going to apply to every society, a template which puts the West and, you know, French society or Quebecois society, at a head start.
And without getting a lot of angry mail from our Quebecois listeners, I, you know, only Only in a 21st century that is bizarre beyond belief could Quebecois people ever think that they are at the the summit of Western civilization. Can I, can I ask, because you brought up intersectionality, if not explicitly, implicitly. So, and we'll close out with this. There is a feminist movement or a feminist sensibility and a sentiment, and it's particularly strong among women, but it also is men, people who see, we can debate the definition of feminism, but there's a feminist worldview. And then is it also partly when you talk about developing world women, which I guess is already a loaded term, but say Muslim women as they're treated by, an archetypal white heterosexual feminist. And I'm getting ahead of myself. How much does sexual orientation, how much does origin, birth origin matter? How much does religion, how much does gender, how much does education level? Intersectionality claims that, effectively there is no single total identity that controls a person or that is most important. Is part of what you're talking about here kind of a recognition of the limits of feminism as a way of uniting people, not because feminism isn't wrong and not because women don't have broadly similar experiences that they can share and that creates a bond between them that are among them that is distinct from ones that they might have with men. But it's also that we live in a truly postmodern age where we know that no one theory, no one identity, no one idea is actually going to explain very much. And it's just that what might be considered a crisis in feminism or feminist unity around the globe is simply a reflection of the fact that, maybe an educated lawyer from Pakistan has more in common with an educated lawyer from America than they do with the person, their next door neighbors who are plumbers or are, Catholic and they're Protestant, et cetera.
Well, I agree with you to the extent that their identity is complex, and there are many, demands on how we negotiate that within, different parts. I think that feminism can be at the forefront of your politics, and the critique from the global South toward white Western feminism is that it talks the talk, but it doesn't. So, for instance, I'll give you a very concrete example that I've been studying. Canada says it now has a feminist international development policy, which means that they're, and this is great, they're going to give 95% of their development aid to programs for women. But at the same time, they continue to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, for instance, and participate in other military adventures which directly impact women and their lives. So it's that sort of thing that is problematic, because if we want, as feminists, to place gender identity front and center as the basis of our political decision making, then you have to consider those conundrums, and then you have to talk about them. You can't just use feminism as this sort of selling point or this wrapping paper for all sorts of other things. And that involves some very contentious conversations. And it also involves taking a back seat, which I think is, it's genuinely hard for Western women, because their idea of inclusion for a long time has been, okay, well, if I give an award to an Afghan woman, then it's fine if they're not at the policymaking dinner the next day. And that's the problem. The problem is that, that women are being included in the women from different backgrounds and different religions and the global South, but they're not being included in meaningful ways. because that involves necessarily ceding power, at least to some extent. And that's the challenge before the feminist movement right now.
Well, we will leave it there. And, you know, at the risk of making a 1960s era sitcom joke, if you're telling women to take a back seat, if you're telling American women to take a back seat, you're gonna be sleeping on the couch for a long time.
There's a lot of American Muslim women.
Yeah.
They could take the French seat.
Yes, there you go. Well, thank you so much. We have been talking with Rafia Zakaria. Her most recent book is Veil. She also wrote a history of Pakistani marriage, I guess, called The Upstairs Wife, which is a highly reviewed and wonderful book. She writes widely in places like The Baffler and Boston Review and elsewhere. Rafia, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Nick. This is awesome.
The new book is Veil. Check it out. This has been The Reason Podcast, and I have been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.